It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee. For those of you who routinely listen to the show, welcome back. And, you know, funny thing about live radio, it doesn't always go perfectly. So, Ian, we do it this way on purpose, because what fun would it be to just do three takes and then pretend everything was perfect in the perfect world? Might be good for some people, not for us. So here we are. If you're new to the show, don't let the first couple minutes bother you. Things are actually moving along pretty swiftly for the most part, and we will be much better off shortly. And I just got a text from our Western Florida people who said it's coming through loud and clear to them, and I'm very appreciative to hear that. So whatever we're doing right now, let's just keep with it. Oh, let's see. What?
I said that's great, because it wasn't going so smoothly on my end.
But, good.
Hopefully good from here on out.
So what part of the Big Apple are you taking a bite out of today?
Yeah, so I'm sitting in Midtown Manhattan, and we are finishing up our summer trip. We worked our way up the East Coast. This is our final stop, and it's been awesome. It's really been a lot of fun. Manhattan is what it always is, busy, fun, crowded, just all of the things that you would imagine. And it doesn't seem like there's much of a recession going on here, because everywhere is packed. And people are out spending money for sure.
Well, that's what it's going to take. That just adds to the ongoing confusion of what the heck is going on in the American economy. And I got a little more on that today. It's just so crazy and unpredictable out there. We've been saying this for pushing 2 years now, I think, and it doesn't make itself clear. So we kind of have to operate within the various and sundry parameters that can change day to day, topic to topic, and so on. But the one thing that you can count on is that there's a lot of interesting things to talk about in a time like this, and we will do exactly that. So after the first break, we will have a trivia question as usual, and it's a good one, because this week saw some interesting activity, not just in the market, but related to the market and so on and so forth. And it's going to take us a little while to get through some of this, but I did want to make one public service announcement first, that being congratulations to the Florida Panthers. Took them 7 games, but they've collected the championship again, which kind of certifies Florida as the hockey capital of North America. How ironic is that?
You can't play hockey in Florida. What are you talking about?
Apparently, you not only can play it, you can play it pretty well. You know, it took them, they're 3-up, and then that got to 3-3 with Edmonton, and they came back to Florida and wrapped it up 2-1 in a cliffhanger, and they walked away the champ. So congratulations, boys. Good job. All right. In the market this week, it looked like it was maybe going to shoot on to some new record highs. That didn't quite happen. It was a little bit of a pullback right at the end following the debate. Whether that had anything to do with it or not, I don't know. But it did wind up the first 6 months of the year. And I guess without anything further to say, I'll leave it up to Adam to say what's it worth, and then we'll get to our trivia question that really kind of puts the capital on what's it worth. So take it away.
Yeah, for sure. It was a really good start to the year. I'll take that first half of the year anytime. Any year that wants to come out like out of the gate like that, I'm all in for. And even though markets were pretty much unchanged this week, we didn't see any real dramatic moves coming off the news, and there was no shortage of news. So that is mildly encouraging to me. Whether you interpret the news as good or bad, a lot of the news this week you really could interpret either way, and it depends on a variety of factors. I think the biggest news of the week, though, was summed up best by the Babylon Bee headline that stated, Trump indicted for murdering elderly man on CNN.
And I saw that this morning. It cracked up.
Yeah. It was that was the biggest news of the week. It didn't really have much of an effect on the market, which is not surprising.
Yeah, but they were wrong, Adam. They were wrong. That headline was wrong. That was a suicide.
That's fair. maybe elder abuse. Who knows what you want to call it. But I think that most Americans place way more importance on politics when it comes to their investments than the actual effect of politics on their investments.
That's a good line and a great segue into today's program, I think. So you're absolutely right.
People are very quick to think that the other side, quote unquote, is always going to ruin the economy or whatever it might be, but the economy sometimes doesn't really care. The economy is made up of a bunch of businesses, which are essentially a bunch of people who are out with a common goal, which is profits. And if you give them a set of rules, they will navigate through it and try and improve those profits. And so therefore, the politics matter to you personally, but they matter much less to the people running those companies when it comes to their common goal of creating profits. And so I think that's why it's always a bad idea to trade on political news. I did see that somehow 33% of Americans still thought that Biden won the debate, and that kind of made me wonder if watching debate was a prerequisite to answer that poll.
It was actually the opposite of that.
What do you mean?
You couldn't have watched it and come to that conclusion.
There's no way. There is no way that if you are a thinking person that could be your conclusion. But so it was definitely an interesting week, and I was glad to see the market didn't trade a lot on the news because that wouldn't have been right. There were some moves that we'll talk about after the break, but they weren't huge.
Yeah, agreed. On all fronts, actually. I think it would have been a big mistake to assume that because the pretty obvious point was that Trump won, that the market's going to go through the roof. That's just not one of the factors that's going to cause it. All right, we'll take our first very quick break. Be right back. Talk more about this. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we have, as usual, lines open, 904-222-8255, and a trivia question sponsored by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Kenny at 904-636-7888. We've had as Adam mentioned, a remarkable start to the year with the broad market, S&P up over 15%. And taking a look back over the years, what typically is the return on the S&P for the balance of the year when it starts out at 15% or better? And I'm going to really be nice this week because, hey, do I sound older, by the way? I am older. I got older yesterday. We send our mutual birthday cards back and forth to the two people I share with, Elon Musk and I can never think of his name, the funny guy. Anyway. Spaceballs. Mel Brooks, thank you. We have a broad range because it could be negative. Last week I didn't give you this, but it's a positive return and a whole number. So while there's probably no way for you to go back and calculate it, this is where good solid guessing and bracketing comes in. So if you want to take a shot at it, what's the positive return for the S&P following a start like we just had? It's a whole number. All right. Again, back to the market this week, Adam. What do you got?
Yeah, so that positive whole number, too. The S&P, if you look on just a price basis, you'll see that the S&P was up 14.5% in the first half of the year. But if you look on a total return basis, which includes dividends, you'll see that it was up over 15%.
Index excludes dividends, which is something that people who are looking at equity index annuities ought to know, because when they try to link it to the S&P 500, you don't get the dividends, they do, just so everybody knows that. That's an important feature of the S&P.
So yeah, you need to include you need to look at total return in answering that question. Mm-hmm. Just a little bit of an asterisk by that. However, for the week, the S&P and the Dow both notched weekly losses of 0.1%, so very narrow losses, and the NASDAQ logged a weekly gain of 0.2%, so kind of made up for the other two. It didn't stop it from being another great quarter unless you only invest in Dow stocks.
Yeah.
For the quarter, the NASDAQ was up 8.3%, and as I mentioned, the S&P for the quarter, the S&P was up 4.3%. The Dow struggled a bit, though. It has actually struggled a bit relative to the other indexes since 2022, and it was actually down 1.7%. It did post a positive month in June, gaining 2.6%, and it's positive for the year, up by 3.8%. But it's really lagging when you compare that to the S&P, which I mentioned was up 14.5%, and then in the NASDAQ, really, really lagging. The NASDAQ is up 18.1%. So the Dow just not doing that well recently. It's also a bit ironic because you keep hearing that the market is being led higher by mega cap stocks only, and the Dow is made up of 30 of the largest stocks in America. And that narrative isn't wrong, by the way. The S&P is being led higher by mega cap stocks, but it's only certain mega cap stocks, and they're mostly in the tech arena. So big divergence between Dow stocks and, say, NVIDIA and Apple.
Yeah, in fact, the typical stock in the S&P 500 actually was down for the quarter. There's very little breadth to the market, which is one of the underlying worries that a lot of people are showing right now.
Definitely. And there's two ways that can go. The stocks that are leading can sort of revert back to the mean and go down to meet the other stocks, or the market can see a broad rally and kind of catch up to those other stock, the mega cap stocks that are leading the way higher. So we don't really know which way that's going to shake out. But those are kind of the two options at this point.
Yeah, and if you believe that the others are going to play catch-up, then you might want to look into the equal-weighted S&P 500 index. There are exchange-traded funds that track that. And then if it's true, then the smaller stocks will get equal treatment to the bigger ones on the way up. So if you believe small caps are due for, or smaller companies, not small caps, if you believe that they are due for a rise, that's something to check into. And I'm going to monitor that second half of the year and see how true it was.
Speaking of small caps actually outperformed this week. I haven't said that in a long time.
It's one of the reasons I brought it up.
Yeah, it was notable, too. They were the small cap index was up over 1%. None of the other indexes really moved at all, so that was nice to see. Mm-hmm. There was no real winner between growth and value stocks either. In large caps, growth outperformed value. But if you look at mid-cap stocks, value outperformed growth. In small caps, growth was the winner again. So there wasn't really a clear winner on dividing it up that way. Inside the S&P, energy had the best week, gaining 2.4%. And a lot of that happened before the debate, so that really wasn't a political issue. I don't know what was driving that trade. The worst week was a tie between materials and utilities, both of which lost 1%. So a pretty tight range between the best performing and worst performing sectors of the S&P. Commodities were mixed. Oil gained 1.2%. Gold posted a slight gain, but silver and agricultural commodities were down. And natural gas somehow managed to lose another 8%. Just crazy.
It's magic.
I mean, I didn't even know it had anything left to lose, but it managed to do it again.
Well, I know it's not true, but it seems like it must be a heavier-than-air gas, doesn't it? It just keeps getting drawn lower and lower.
Fixed income had a bit of a rough week. Long treasuries lost 2.3%, while the overall market was off 0.7%. International markets were also mixed, with the all-world index gaining 0.4%. Some notable performances included Japan, which was up 3.4%, India up 2%, while Hong Kong was down 1%, and France was down 1.6%. So it was a mixed week overseas. One canary in the coal mine signal I noticed this week was credit card delinquency rates. Mm-hmm. The national delinquency rate for all loans and leases is still historically low at 1.4%, but it's been trending up in the second quarter, and that's from the lowest rate ever, which was set in the second half of 2022. Part of the reason it's trending up now is the credit card delinquency rate. It has crept up to 3.16%. That's the highest rate since 2011. That's 13 years. That's quite high. Credit card charge-offs are also now above pre-pandemic levels. So that's something to keep an eye on. We've been hearing about record credit card debt for a while, but the delinquency rate had remained really, really low. But now it's in a pretty clear upward trend. And that's not really something we want to see. That's a negative sign.
No, the credit card companies are experiencing a lot of volume because it's a response to the inflationary cycle. People are having to put more and more things on their credit cards, and that is directly or indirectly at least influencing the default rate. And it's kind of scary. It's another one of those things where we keep talking about it's so hard to predict the economy, and that one shows the underbelly of a soft spending pattern, I guess, for now anyway.
Yeah, interesting that the credit card charge-off rates have spiked, I would say, and the mm-hmm. overall rate is still at almost historic lows. Why? I guess people are maybe that's the first thing to not get paid when you have to make those hard decisions. You pay your mortgage, but you don't pay the credit card. But interesting that we're seeing that, and hopefully it's not a precursor of things to come. On Friday, the PCE report showed that core prices rose just 1% in May. So that's a pretty good number. That's the lowest rate since 2020.
Yeah, that's the inflation measure that the Fed uses. It's what they prefer. And it came in right at target.
Even better news than that, if you exclude rent, the core prices were absolutely flat mm-hmm. in May. So rent is still driving inflation higher. Well, overall, the number is pretty flat. I thought that was very interesting as well. That's some welcome news.
I would call that an incentive for the Fed to be considering rate decreases.
Definitely. That's one thing the Fed has noted, that they are willing to ignore the effect of house prices and rent on inflation, because specifically rent, because it's such a long-term thing with year leases, that they think that it's going to take a lot longer for rent to roll over than it will for many other goods and services.
Yeah, and I have another little aspect of that too. If we could start getting the lower interest rates, the builders would become much more active, and perhaps we could start creating a little more supply in the market. So, you know, all these things take a long time, but I do think it's becoming more likely by the day that the Fed will issue at least one cut this year. You agree with that?
Yeah, I do.
And it could be too. I don't want to see them do too much. Hesitate to think that because we were all spoiled for so long, that long term they would want to get back down to the zero interest rate policy or the ones and twos. It doesn't bode well for the economy, and it doesn't bode well for people who save money and that sort of thing. And by the way, speaking of saving money, have you seen the 401k balances rising? They're huge. People are saving at a rate that is absolutely extraordinary. But they're falling behind on their credit card payments. Figure that one out. So, all right. We have to take a quick break, and we'll be right back after we pay some bills. Adam's having a little difficulty with the timing on it, too. But we'll be right back. This is the Vanway Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Vanway Financial Hour. I'm Steve Vanway.
And I'm Adam Vanway.
And I remind everybody, lines are open, 904-222-8255. And the trivia question is out there. After the start of the year of 15% plus in the S&P, what is the average second half of the year return? It's positive and a whole number. So So anybody who wants to give it a shot, you got an equal chance of getting it or missing it, right or left, up or down, 50-50. All right. Adam, do you get the feeling that people are kind of fed up with control and government and just...
I have had that feeling for quite some time. But it really depends where you are. I think that in red states, that's clearly the case. I think in blue states, they seem to love it.
Yeah, you're probably right. Do you remember the name Howard Beale?
I do not.
He's a fictional character played by Peter Finch in the 1976 movie Network. And he famously ran over to the window and said, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." And I'm just thinking this morning as I'm reading about that there's quite a few things going on that remind me of 1976. Now, you probably don't remember a lot about that since that was the year you were born and that was in the late part of the year. But I thought an interesting thing happened yesterday in the Supreme Court. Everybody's waiting on some of the great big decisions, but some of the other ones were very interesting. And getting rid of the Chevron rule was one of them. And we've talked for probably decades now about our lawmaking process and the divided portions of government, the checks and balances and so on, where Congress seems to get up in the morning and find ways not to do anything. So they pass laws that are very general in nature, and then they appoint bureaucrats, both from some on the congressional sides and some on the administrative side. And other times they do this through courts, but everybody's making laws that Congress didn't pass specifically. And they just got their wrists slapped pretty hard yesterday in the Supreme Court. This particular one had to do with the forced inspection on fishing vessels, where they had to pay $710 to have someone actually go out there and monitor what they were doing. And that was cutting into the profits of the fishing industry by about 20% whenever the boat had one of those people on. That got thrown out yesterday after a long, long struggle. And I think it's kind of enlightening, and it makes me feel quite a little bit better about the Supreme Court, who has been, in some cases, very unpredictable, but in others, hopefully very predictable. Though I do think some people who expect the court to do things that are just, you know, they're just not going to happen because they'd essentially be saying they're going to break the law. But I thought that one was really good. We need to get the regulators out of our business. And it reminds me, I go back to 1982 when I bought a company from a guy who had been very disappointed because a regulator somewhere had cost him a bunch of money. It was a manufacturing company with Teamsters, and the Teamsters were in the multi-employer pension plan that we've talked about many times, how much trouble it's in. But one day, as things were in recession right at that point, this guy in the middle of the night just decided, "I got an idea how to fix the pension plan. We'll just divide it up among all the employers who didn't go bankrupt." And that day, this company was assessed a $280,000 fine, or whatever you call it, which had to be paid off until it was gone, basically. So making all the pension payments, there was an added component in that for years and years and years. It was so discouraging to the guy that he sold it to us, and I wound up paying all those for decades. And that's the kind of thing that it's just so harmful to business. And I'm looking at this as hopefully a good sign. So just wanted to bring that up.
Was a really good ruling. I was happy to see it. Yep. It takes away power from government-appointed regulators,
right.
And that is something that certainly needs to happen. So think about people that you don't vote for that get put into power and get on, and in a lot of cases seem to get on a power trip and enforce stupid rules that don't make any sense, and there's no way to vote them out. That's the exact thing that this will help curb.
Exactly. Government gets in its own way a lot. And I found an interesting little piece, too, on, you know, the electric charging stations, the 500,000 of them that we're supposed to build by 2030. And there are now seven, last count I could find. I found the reason for that. It is, it's all about DEI, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, which is losing its luster largely among the people, another good sign, I believe. But here's what you have to do to get a charging station built. You have to provide intentional outreach to underserved communities. Examples include neighborhood block parties staffed by multilingual interpreters, according to internal memos obtained by the Free Beacon. This all slows down construction, one said, and it's useless. You got to have a contractor. You got to have minorities working on it. You have to throw parties in your neighborhood to try to draft people to work on it or whatever. And it's just so ludicrous. I can't wrap my brain around it. And in a related incident, Tractor Supply Company just eliminated all of their DEI initiatives as a company because their customers were giving them a lot of backlash. So, you know, just some highlights. Let's talk about something real serious that happens Monday. I don't know how many people know this, but the fiscal year of the state of Florida starts on Monday. It actually starts on July 1, which happens to be Monday this year. But on that day, there are a lot of laws and changes and legislative actions and on and on. In other words, things change that day. And one of the things that changed that day is directly related to something that's been bothering you and bothering me and probably everybody listening for a long time. The insurance industry is really devastating Florida's home market because things are so expensive and rising so fast. So the governor, it's nice to have a good governor, isn't it? Governor had called a special session to work on it, and they passed something called My Safe Florida Home, and it is being implemented on Monday, and it's going to help an awful lot of people, lower-income people especially. It's going to help them better prepare for disasters and hopefully mitigate some losses in advance. And I wanted to just talk a little bit about what that is. Have you read through the details, Adam?
I have not. No, I haven't. I haven't seen this.
Okay. The home inspections, wind mitigation home inspections, are being offered now by the Department of Financial Services, and it's going to start out between $140,000 and $145,000 home inspections. They have to be site-built, meaning they can't be mobile homes. They need to be single-family residences or townhouses that are eligible to apply for wind mitigation inspection. Then this inspection is meant to find things that could be improved, or it actually works two ways. When they find things that are good, it'll help you negotiate with your insurance company. When they find things are bad, there are going to be subsidies that help people fix up their homes to better qualify for better rates. Now, this is not a be-all and end-all to solve Florida's problems. With a lot of people in danger of losing their homes because they can't afford things like the homeowner's insurance, this could help. So here's how it goes. You have to apply, and you have to apply in a very, very concise window. So it starts out Monday. Low-income homeowners age 60-plus have to apply between July 1 and July 15th. Then, in general, low-income homeowners between the 16th and the 30th, any age. Then we go to moderate-income homeowners age 60-plus. That's July 31 to August 14. Then moderate-income homeowners any age between August 15th and 30th. And after August 30th, all other eligible homeowners. Okay, who's eligible? That makes sense. Low income means 80% or less of the median household income of your county. Moderate income means 120% or less of the median household income of your county. So you have to dig up the stats in your own county to find out if you qualify. If so, you fill out an application, and they'll come in and do a free inspection of your house and tell you all the good and all the bad. And if you want to then make some changes, they will pay two-thirds of your fix-up costs up to $10,000. So there's a lot of people living in areas in Florida that are very much subject to things like windstorms, naturally. And some of those people can hopefully get a little help on this. As I said, this is not something that's supposed to fix the entire problem. But if we could start out with 140, 145,000 homes in Florida and mitigate their risk, it accrues directly to the financial health of the insurance companies. It's one of the reasons that now we are getting insurance companies moving back into Florida. And I congratulate the governor and everybody else, because we will be in grave danger of having people priced out of their homes real fast if this isn't fixed and fixed better. So if this step works, I'm sure the next session of the legislature will take it a little further and try to do even more good. Just a little something on the good news front. Again, we'll take all of that we can get these days. All right, one more quick break, and then we'll be right back with some more goodies. Don't go anywhere. This is the Vanwee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Vanwee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Vanwee.
And I'm Adam VanWee.
And I remind everybody the lines are open, 904-222-8255. And the trivia question is still out there. After a booming start to the year for the first half of over 15% in the S&P, what is the average return for the second half of the year? And it's a positive whole number. All right. I got one that's probably going to surprise you, and I got a lot of this info from Clark Howard's website. And those of you who are familiar with Clark know that he has so much stuff on there that you just can't imagine going through it, and it's all about the consumer. So I really appreciate the work he does and have for many, many years now. But do you think a credit bureau, and you know them, Equifax, TransUnion, and Experian, do you think they should be able to share your personal information that includes your Social Security number for profit? I think most people listening to that would say, well, no. Isn't that kind of the whole idea that we use these bureaus? Because somebody's got to be responsible enough that they can actually do a good job and protect you while they can actually protect the sellers of whatever it is you're looking for, because everybody wants to know if you're a good risk or a bad risk or whatever. So I kind of thought, like most people probably did, that this was something that they just do and it's kind of a convenience and a service. Wrong-o. They are allowed to share your personal information. Not only that, that is their business model. That's how they make money. They are willing and able to collect all of your information and market it to various and sundry sellers. Clark used a Dish Network as an example. So that when these people get all your information and understand your credit risk, they can approach you. Their marketing department can approach you knowing pretty well what they're going to find out if you do business. And I find this rather appalling. But guess what? There's a free fix available. Many people have already done it. Many have not. They will not be able to do this if you freeze your credit with all of the bureaus. Freezing your credit is as simple as getting online to each of them and implementing a credit freeze. And I do not mean a paid-for credit lock from a credit card company or a car dealership or anything like that. I mean a complete credit freeze. Unless you're applying for new credit in any way, shape, or form, there is no reason that I have been able to find in my considerable years on this earth not to freeze your credit. When you do go out and apply for credit and somebody says, well, I can't get your information because it's frozen, say, okay, who are you going to ask, and when are you going to ask them? Then you go in, you unfreeze it for a specific time period for a specific person. The second they call you and say, got it, you put the freeze right back on. That is free. It is your right as an American to do it. And that has this wonderful added advantage of making sure that your information will not be marketed by these companies to various and sundry merchants. I can't think of anything that is that inexpensive, easy, and worthwhile. So if you haven't done it, do it. That's my humble opinion. All right, got anything in particular you want to talk about, Adam? I got a few other goodies.
Yeah, I just found an article this week that referenced a Principal Financial Group study. And there were some really concerning things in this article, but the most concerning one was that 59% of respondents who thought they were contributing to their 401k were actually not contributing to their 401k.
Oh.
So I'm not quite sure how you could make that mistake. I mean, it seems pretty obvious that if there's a payroll deduction going to a 401k, it would be on your pay stub. Maybe you're not looking at your pay stub. But what it made me want to say is just go out there and check. If you're listening to this program and you think you're contributing to your 401k, pull up a pay stub this week and take a look and make sure that you are actually diverting funds into your 401k, because 59% of respondents is a really, really big number.
No kidding.
It seems like something that wouldn't even pass the smell test, but that's what this principal group study found. So get out there and check on that.
You know, that looking back in the old days when I was way younger than you are now, we used to get paid with a check, and that check had a pay stub on it, and then you'd take it to the bank and deposit it. Well, in the age of electronics, you don't get that. You look at your bank balance, and it's higher that day. Most people probably never have looked at a check stub unless they have some very specific reason to do so, but they are available. And if you don't know how to find yours, you can get it from your employer. So don't hesitate to get a little nosy. It's your records. And I'm kind of appalled sitting here just thinking about what you just said.
Yeah, really jumped off the page at me.
Do we know where that money's going?
I mean, I assume they're just taking it home instead of putting it into their 401k, and they don't realize it. And I think
it's not like theft, in other words. It's just misconception or misleading.
Nothing like that.
Ah. That's better than having it stolen, but not by much. Every day you miss.
Spent instead of saved.
Yeah. Every day you miss contributing, you're doing yourself a very bad disservice. Time in the market and all that. Dollar cost.
There's been a lot of changes to 401k plans in recent years. A lot of companies are going to automatic opt-ins, meaning you have to actually choose to not contribute. Mm-hmm. I think that's a great change to 401ks. A lot of companies are setting it up so that you start at like 1 or 3%, and it automatically increases unless you opt out of that as well. So what's happening is that the employers are choosing plans that they don't force you to contribute more, but it makes it much more likely that you are going to contribute, even if you don't think about it. The default would be to contribute and to increase your contributions. I really like that. It does give you the opportunity to opt out of it, but I think that making Americans think about their retirement more and force them to do something about it is a much better system than making them opt into it, which is very difficult, especially when you're young and don't have a lot of money and aren't making a ton of money. It's always easier. Well, it always seems better to have the money in your pocket than in your 401k when you're in your 20s and don't have anything. So I really like those changes, but 59% think that they're saving and they're not. That's a big problem.
That's unbelievable. I have read the statistic, the percentage of people I guess you'd call it a participation rate, percentage of workers that are in 401ks has risen dramatically. I believe that the auto enrollment thing was part of Secure 1.0, so it hasn't been all that many years, but it has been very effective. And I'm kind of curious why a number like that is still out there. If you get started, two things happen to you. First off, you never see the money, so it's out of sight, out of mind, and it goes into your plan. And the other one is you get that automatic dollar cost averaging effect, and most people are reluctant to actually have to go to the process, go through the work to sign themselves up. Well, those same people probably won't go through the process to take themselves out. I think is one of the more brilliant moves that has been implemented toward American retirement in a long, long time. So I categorically agree.
I think it does a third thing, too. It helps you get to that point where you go from fearing saving to becoming obsessed with saving, because hitting milestones can make you really, really want to focus on saving. And what I mean by that is when you put your first $75 deposit into a 401k, it's boring. I mean, you get a 10% return on that. Do the math. It's nothing. It's nothing. But once you start hitting milestones like 10,000, 50,000, 100,000, then the numbers start to get real and it becomes exciting and you want to save more because you see the actual positive effect on your balance of compound interest and things like that, and the growth, and it becomes much more exciting. And so, but the problem is getting started is so painful and boring. And so I think that the more people that start the process, the more people will want to be actively participating in the process.
In our day jobs, we have many examples of that very same thing, where people never really thought that much about how much they had, and then all of a sudden they start coming to people like us and have quarterly reviews and look at their plans, and all of a sudden they're more digits than they used to be. And then it becomes slowly and surely something of an obsession, which is a good thing. It's something good to be obsessed over, because you got to start early and you got to keep at it. Dollar cost averaging works. I think maybe the music just started playing because that Adam doesn't seem to hear me anymore. So thanks, Adam, whatever. And the second half return on a year where the S&P starts out at 15% or better averages 7%. So there's a very good likelihood. It's not a guarantee. There aren't many of those in life anymore. But there's a very good likelihood that by the end of this year, we'll all be doing even a little bit better than we are now. And that's a chance I'm certainly willing to take. So don't be frightened by anything that's going on. Just stay with it. Play by the rules. Have fun. Stay safe and warm and all that for 4th of July. And we'll see you next week.